Right, hello. Are you okay with chairs and everything? Sorry about that. Hello, my name's Maggie Bolton. I'm Director of Public Arts South West, and welcome to our regional network meeting. Some of you who are frequent attendees will notice that we've changed our format this time. And with the invitation to attend this event, we detailed our plans for having two set venues now in the region, one in the north and one in the south, starting with an earlier time, 11 o'clock, and providing lunch, which allows for more networking and accommodates people's travelling arrangements. We welcome feedback on these changes, and you can either give feedback to myself or Lisa today or any thoughts later on in the coming months, because we want to make sure that these events are as useful as possible for people. Today's topic can sometimes be quite a controversial one in some people's eyes, given the emphasis on global warming, carbon emissions, and concerns over growing light pollution. But the fact of the matter is that we rely on light to not only illuminate, but to welcome, create safety, identity, and emphasise areas of interest. And in order to be able to debate this topic in the round, we invited Oliver Bennett, the journalist, to write a keynote piece for us, which he is presenting today, and an extract of which was circulated with your booking papers. Oliver presents us with an intriguing overview, which I know will stimulate much thought. We also have presentations from Mark Luck, urban designer for North Somerset District Council, and also working with Public Arts South West as our planning associate. And he'll be talking from the Commissioner's perspective of why involve an artist rather than a lighting engineer. And then we also welcome Jim Buckley, an artist, on what he feels is the added value that's brought by him working in this way and this area. And one topic I think Jim is going to touch on is how his proposals can also help act as an early warning system for flood alerts, which is an interesting development and links to other initiatives which are exploring multi-use, like the clear paint which contains titanium dioxide which reacts with pollutants and breaks them down and renders them harmless, which is being applied to existing and new buildings and which is being trialled with the involvement of Central St Martin's College of Art and Design, amongst other partners. So maybe we are opening up a whole new era of public art projects with a mission. We also have plenty of opportunity for discussion at the end of the presentations. And for your information, we are recording the day's events, which will be presented in the form of a podcast, which will be broadcast on Arts Professional website in a couple of weeks' time, and of course our own. So can I now introduce you to our resident chairperson, like being called a chair, Andrew Kelly, who's going to further set the scene for this morning and introduce the speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Thank you very much, Maggie. I've actually read what Ollie was going to talk about, so I want to be as brief as possible, because I think it's a very exciting presentation. When we were discussing what the subject of this network meeting should be, we felt that we'd looked at lighting a number of times at previous network meetings, but had never really focused on lighting on its own as a topic, so we were particularly keen to put forward this as the theme today, and we're pleased that all of you are here today to join the discussion. We want to make sure that this is a discussion and not just a series of presentations, so there, as Maggie said, there's plenty of time for questions both after each presentation and in a plenary session at the end, but I'll hope you also use the time in between with the lunch and so on to network and to talk more. I want to introduce, before I introduce the speakers again, just some fairly routine things. The lunch is served in the bar where you were having your teas and coffees this morning, and toilets are either side that way. That's like an air hostess, isn't it? They're both sides, as I say. When we looked at this topic, we read Oliver's article in Landscape Vista about lighting scenes, and we were very keen to make sure that we got someone of Oliver's calibre here to give not just a talk, but actually to think through some of the issues that we were concerned with. And that's why we've dubbed it as a keynote presentation. Oliver has a long-standing interest in the subjects of regeneration and cultural tourism. He's worked in art and design for publishing and journalism now, where he's a self-employed journalist and an editor with over 20 years experience. Oliver's going to talk on really historic views of the special qualities that an artist brings to lighting projects and schemes, as it's said in your pack, that a lighting engineer does not and cannot, and Oliver ranges very widely. He's also got some books he's going to recommend to you, so he's going to show you those books and then perhaps have a look at those later on in the break. So thank you very much, and would you welcome Oliver Bennett? Thank you.
Hi. Hi, thanks very much. Well, first things first, I mean, I bought these in order to try and project them, and that isn't going to be possible, so I'm afraid I'm just going to have to hold them up and show you the page, and then put the pile there if you want to look through them later. And I recommend, in particular, Architecture of the Night, which is an excellent book. But anyway, in coming to this, and thanks very much for that incredibly kind intro, I sort of romped through the history of sort of light in public art and design, and hopefully it'll throw up some sort of ideas and arguments. One of the things that really intrigued me about this, and we discussed this before I came, was this idea that kind of light is becoming a little bit of a sort of bogeyman, if you like. And so I wanted to start with the whole sort of dark skies movement, and to talk about the fact that on the 31st of March this year, an organisation called Earth Hour invited Sydneysiders in Australia to turn on their lights for 1 hour. And I was quite struck by this, and also by, because it reminded me of the sort of cinema advert, which a lot of us have probably seen, in which the music of Jana Newsom plays over pictures of the New York blackouts 3 years ago, in a commercial that advertises mobile phones, of all things. And the strap line is, sometimes things need to switch off before people switch on. And it sort of occurred to me that there was a sort of emerging romance of lightlessness, if you like, augmenting the increasingly vocal dark skies lobby that for several years has been campaigning against the excessive and ineffectual use of light. Do you mind if I sit down, actually?
No.
Most notable among them is the Campaign for Dark Skies, which has campaigned against the overlighting of Britain since 1989, when it emerged from the British Astronomical Association to spearhead a campaign against light pollution and sky glow. Since that time, as we all know, the dark sky effort has gained wider interest, mainly due to the environmental concern, and also the conservationists' interest in preserving a wilderness, in this case, a wilderness of the night sky. Indeed, it's quite interesting. I think the movement, the dark skies movement, is being sort of knitted in with other international quality of life movements, such as the slow food movement, for instance. And indeed, the slow food movement has Sit Us Slow, or maybe that should be Chit Us Slow or something, which is their international network of slow food cities. The international dark sky movement is trying to bring a similar thing on. And it's the first one was inaugurated in 2001, Flagstaff in Arizona. That struck me as interesting. First, because Flagstaff isn't far from Las Vegas, the sort of 20th century city of light par excellence. Classic Las Vegas picture of the Strip, where the lights in the Strip, every so often they shut the lights out for kind of important events. The last time was Ronald Reagan's death in 2004, which was made particularly significant because it was in Las Vegas, which is a sort of byword for light displays, from neon to lasers to all kinds of new technologies. Las Vegas is the place, I believe, where the phrase "can be seen from space" was invented in order as a sort of civic boast. This was, in fact, the seventh time that the lights of the famous Strip have been turned off, and previous occasions have been for the death of President Kennedy and for 9/11. And, in fact, it's quite interesting that light has been so important to Las Vegas that this book actually has a section designing with electricity, indicating that kind of light can not only be, you know, enhance architecture, but be architecture. It also was quite interesting, the idea of turning lights off to sort of commemorate in a memorial function. I'll come back to that later, because to be very basic about it, lighting symbolises life and the lack of it symbolises death. Since early animist societies, the sun was revered as a giver of life, and therefore one of the earliest ways of expressing the world in symbolic terms. I say all the dark sky stuff by way of introduction because public lights public light in public spaces is more prevalent than ever, and indeed more vexatious than ever. In the last few years, any sort of matter involving, you know, extraneous, if you like, use of electric light elicits strong reactions, as I'm sure a lot of you know. Light consumes energy, and so new lighting projects have to address criticism that they are potentially wasteful, or worse, conceived of as contributing to light pollution. This is a whole sort of situation in progress, and I'd be very interested to hear all your views about it later, because in recent years we've witnessed no less than a flourishing of light in the public realm. Here in Western Supermare, for instance, there's a lighting programme that Mark is going to talk about later. And it's happening all across the country, and indeed across the developed world, if you will. I'd say probably the last 10 or 20 years has seen the rise of sort of architectural lighting to become a commonplace. Landmark buildings such as churches are routinely lit at night. Lighting created by artists and designers is used by many local authorities in conjunction with public arts bodies to add value, drama and interest. Just in the last few years, there's been light festivals at York Minster, to Tyneside, to the Thames, programmes of creative lighting that have, in a way, without wishing to overstate the case, have unveiled a whole new public art agenda. Among the various festivals have been, and there's been several one-off installations as well. Newcastle had Glow, Glasgow in 2005 had Radiance, Dazzle was a collective of winter festivals in the northeast, and Switched on London earlier this year was a showcase of lighting, and London's first festival of light. I've got a magazine, I know the publisher's in the room as well. This was what they did to HMS Belfast by, it was Campbell Design, for instance. Again, a mixture of artists and designers working together to sort of create this festival of light. A couple of weeks ago, Hamburg had a maritime festival, including a light show by the light architect Gert Hoff, and a light installation in Newcastle that's just opened, designed by the artist Nyan Kulkarni, called Nocturne, for instance. So this is something that every month there seems to be a new light initiative, and it just indicates that there's a bit of a boom in lighting festivals. There's an international body of sort of involved in this called LUCI, the Lighting Urban Community International, which brings together a network of cities with a lighting strategy. And clearly technology has its place in sort of helping to promote these festivals. The advantages of LED, you know, have given commissioners a lot of new opportunities. So anyway, who is making all this light work? And I think the answer to that is actually quite a lot of different people. Roger Narboni, who wrote the 2004 book Lighting the Landscape, Art, Design and Technologies, claims that lighting designers have become a recognised profession in the last two decades. Equally, the new direction in public lighting has come from artists as well as lighting designers, architects and engineers. In other words, it's not just the technologists who do it, it's artists as well. And I think that's very important, and I think we can discuss that later perhaps about what these different sort of strands of knowledge bring to the kind of the arena. There's also a kind of new kind of specialist hybrid artist designer, among them Jason Bruges, who contributed to the London Lighting Festival, Chris Levine, Patrice Warren and Raphael Dayden. And there are socially conscious light artists, such as Veronica Vald, who is conducting experiments to alleviate seasonal affective disorder in Estonia, which chimes with the notion that artificial light can offer social benefits, such as alleviating depression, even antisocial activity, as well as, of course, the often quoted enhanced security. It's easy to see, I think, why light has become so popular. Obviously, much of the new lighting is dramatic, site-specific and time-based, turning environment into event. It captures sort of aspects of celebration which have long been associated with light. You know, the emotional and symbolic and even conceptual aspects of light. also not only is light an effective and affordable medium, but it can work on several levels. It can offer sheer visual sensation, it can create different atmospheres, and it draws the eye. For these reasons, light is often used to make the point that an area is valued. From ex-industrial warehouses to waterside landscapes, lighting has become an essential visual cue of the regeneration process. What's more, lighting programmes are often temporary and reversible, making it easier to work with historic structures and within planning requirements. Fundamental to this, I think, is light's emotional appeal. It's that light is a symbol of change and hope, which means that as an artistic medium, it presents an accessible face to the wider public. Christmas lights and seaside illuminations, for instance, remain expressions of popular sentiment, and they have a part in mass celebration. Also, and importantly, light artworks are seen as accessible in a way that perhaps other artistic and public art artistic interventions are not. Simon Smith, an officer for Glasgow's Radiance Festival, said in the Times, "Light is very easily understood. It doesn't require any particularly deep reading." Edward Esham, the director of the ICA, said, "If the purpose is to create something that can unite people in a sense of joy and wonder, then light is one of the first places that you look." And the arts ambassador for Birmingham, Nigel Edmondson, cited the perception of safety as one benefit and added that in value for money terms, light is very effective in terms of what it can do to change environments and mood. Some of its appeal, I'm sure, lies in its roots as a religious or spiritual symbol. And indeed, light has long been used to present the ineffable, not only in terms of the rays of light used in medieval art to indicate the presence of God, perhaps emanating from a cloud, for instance. Light, says a dictionary of symbols in Christian art, is the universal symbol in all major religious traditions of the unknowable power, beauty, and mystery of God. The medieval mystic Robert Ross Test had light as the most direct corporeal manifestation of the divine, the mediator between bodiless and bodily substance, at the same time sexual body and embodied spirit. Light, he noted, which could pass through glass without breaking it, was likened to the word of God passed through the body of the Virgin. Now, few people probably would subscribe to those theological ideas about light in this context, but those ideas seem to have passed along the centuries into the idea of the light as expressing the sublime. This is most obvious in the work of James Turrell, who I think is probably the best known artist working in light today, and who has, you know, actually managed to kind of cross the boundary of working in art areas to working in design areas. For instance, there's a couple of Turrell pictures here. Where he illuminated the Pont du Gard in Nîmes. And he's done a more architectural scheme also in France here, which I'd recommend having a look at later. The Nîmes is particularly amazing, I think. You can really get the sense of it. But, you know, will you be able to do that in 5 years' time? Who knows? There was an exhibition last year in Cincinnati Art Gallery in America called The Magic of Light, which presented work by several artists, including Turrell. And I was quite interested in a little description in the catalogue introduction about it. "We cannot touch it or hold it, but we can see it and with it see our world. Light defines our physical, visual and mental experiences. It determines how we move and stirs our emotions. The concept of life as light is filled with a multitude of interpretations, ideas and possibilities. It is a literal source of insight and a metaphorical image of revelation." It's interesting that when people talk about Turrell and other artists working in light, such as Dan Flavin, importantly, they often go back to the spiritual idea. Turrell comes from the Quaker tradition, they tell us, and Flavin was once in a Catholic seminary. It's obviously a sort of compelling part of the way that kind of light is presented. Terrell, one of his, the ways that he has kind of approached the use of light is to sort of use it in a figure ground way to suggest either solidity or absence. And supposedly, when he showed one of his illuminations at New York, at the Whitney Museum in New York, several visitors mistook the light for a wall and fell through, lengthened and fell through it. So I think, basically, coming back to the use of light, it does sort of revert to this idea of the sense of wonder, and maybe even is sort of reinvigorating the idea of the sense of wonder in public art terms. When electricity first came to the cities, to our cities in the 1880s, light was a source of fascination. People would actually go to see an electric light, partly because a single light bulb was cost half a day's wages, and 1 kilowatt of electric power would cost the equivalent of an hour's labour, but also because of the magic of it all. The first public electricity supply in the UK was in Surrey in 1881, and I've got a good picture of an engraving of one of the first electric arc lights in Madison Square, New York, which sort of, the fact that they thought it was noteworthy enough to make an engraving showing the rays, you see, of how this marvellous new thing indicates how sort of important they felt it was. And in fact, something about this kind of like early idea of light being magic sort of reminded me of the Martin Creed piece, Work Number 227. In other words, the lights going on and off that won the Turner Prize in 2001. It wasn't a public favourite, but one made a point that made a point about the simple act of transformation involving light. So light as technological marvel, it's a sort of theme that kind of continues throughout the centuries, and the century and a half that we've had electric light, and which doesn't seem dissipated yet. In Charlotte and Peter Fiel's book for Tashin, A Thousand Lights, which I've got here, which in fact has that lovely picture in, they say that few human endeavours have had such a far-reaching influence on the development of civilization as the invention of artificial light. They point out that just 100 years ago, transforming night into day with the flick of a switch was hailed as nothing short of miraculous. Interestingly, Fiel also alludes to the ecological dilemma that we are experiencing in our own era as well, by saying that the development of artificial life has provided a vital means of independence from the rhythms of nature. That sense of the discordance with the natural order that electric light brings comes back to Las Vegas, where the inability to tell between day and night is used, possibly you might say abused, in order to keep people up and gambling. And already in the 1880s, when public light really started to kind of come onto the scene, there were fears about the new technology. Robert Louis Stevenson said about arc lights in the 1880s, which were considered very vulgar, that the word electricity now sounds a note of danger. A new kind of urban star now shines out nightly, horrible, unearthly, obnoxious. Such a light as this should shine only on murders and public crime. So showing that, you know, to expose things that we didn't want to see, as well as afford more security and, you know, the possibility of kind of revelation. Around this time of early public electricity in the 1880s, the visual arts began their experiments in the fleeting glimpses of retinal perception with Monet and the Impressionists, where light started to become a way to create form. And indeed, this prefigured the modernist interest in perceptual phenomena. It's worth saying, however, that even before artificial light, light was used in a ceremonial way. In fact, in the book The Mind in the Cave, which examines cave painting, and indeed how they managed to actually make pictures in caves that were pitch black, indicated that kind of like lit torches were used to illuminate the paintings in a way that were used ritualistically. Coming right through to kind of 1547, St. Peter's in Rome put up exterior candle holders. And there's a lovely picture of that here. which is very small, so I'm going to have to let you have a look at it later, I think. But just shows that actually the idea of sort of illuminating architecture with light goes back a lot further than the 20th century. In fact, Goethe, who went to see it as a journalist, said, and his last words, incidentally, were famously, "more light." Goethe said, called it a fiery elevation, which is rather nice. And indeed, we had a little bit of that in the UK. The wooden pagoda, there was a wooden pagoda in St James's Park that had 10,000 decorative gas lights on it. And it's a wooden pagoda. Unfortunately, we don't have a contemporary picture of it with all its gas lights lit. But nonetheless, you can get the impression that already we're starting to kind of like move towards the idea of nocturnal architecture being as important as it were, daytime architecture. Of course, when electricity came along, you know, it presented a fantastic opportunity to, you know, look for public celebration and indeed for public spaces and architecture. And its demonstration became a big part of the large 19th century international and world fairs as a source of spectacle. Paris World Fair, for instance, had electric lights placed along a river. And there's a nice little picture of... Where is it? Of the Paris World Fair somewhere here. I might have to show you later. But anyway, well, there's a picture of the Eiffel Tower, an early manifestation of public light. Anyway, it was used as a way to sort of illuminate the space and create a sense of celebration. And indeed, it made me think about the Millennium Celebrations River of Light, which was one of those disappointing aspects of a disappointing night. But it just shows that that idea has kind of lingered. But coming back to kind of like where sort of the idea of light and public light kind of started to fold in, as it were, the avant-garde. All these things obviously didn't escape the sort of eye of the modernists. And the futurists, for instance, found the dynamic essence of electric light to be compelling subject matter. And Giacomo Balla's street lamp of 1909 shows in a way that it's remarkably similar, actually. I haven't got a picture of it here, but it's remarkably similar to this in the sense that it actually depicts a rays coming out of a public light as if to sort of celebrate this, amazing new invention. And indeed, art movement Rayonism quite specifically looked at the idea of light rays as being sort of subject matter for artistic endeavour. Light basically became considered dynamic and progressive. The futurist architect, Antonio Santelia, in his Manifesto of Futurist Architecture said, "We have lost our predilection for the monumental, the heavy, the static, and we have enriched our sensibility with a taste for the light, the practical, the ephemeral and the swift." Electric light suggested everything about what it was to be modern and dynamic and progressive, indeed, and perhaps that lingers today. Indeed, there was an earlier era of light festivals in the second half of the 1920s. They were held across Europe, and some of them attempted to kind of harness the ideas of the avant-garde. There was one called Berlin im Licht in 1928, which convened a committee of artists, architects and businessmen to develop a light festival. And there's a very interesting picture of one that Naum Gabo drew, but doesn't here, which was going to be put all along Unter den Linden. So very interesting use of the then avant-garde as public spectacle. Gabo was joined by people like Theo van Doesburg of De Stijl, who called for a lit architecture, and the behaviour of light became part of artistic inquiry. Mahony Nagy, obviously, and some of the other Bauhaus artists experimented with light, both interior and exterior. And Fernand Léger described, but didn't actually manage to manifest, the idea of projected light frescoes in the 1920s as being a new medium, a fantastic opportunity for artists. Indeed, this was considered such a sort of progressive way of looking at the time that Form magazine, which was a design and art magazine in the 20s, said in 1929, talking about light, "We might ask if our traditional understanding of form, based as it is on material values, might not be replaced by a new and more comprehensive notion." So they developed an interplay between the designers and creators of spectacle and the avant-garde that continues to this day. At the time, notes the writer Dietrich Neumann, many of the lighting designers had begun their careers in the theatre and so had dramatic showperson's mentality. That very much comes over in the big sort of fairs and expos of the time. For instance, there's a usual typical theme, the Eiffel Tower one I showed you, there's a Parisian one which used electric lights along a little water concourse there, and indeed illuminated fountains, an idea that persists. Here in 1920 is Buckingham Fountain in Chicago using a colour projection onto water with musical accompaniment, something that was quite fashionable at the time. Eiffel Tower, and well, there are several others. You come and have a look at the book later. And indeed, by the time 1930 rolled around, the term architecture of night was coined to the idea that buildings had a nocturnal aesthetic as well as a daytime aesthetic. The early modernist architects, Mendelssohn, Bruno Torton, Mies van der Rohe, carefully considered their designs' nocturnal appearances, and it's considered that the nighttime vista was like a photographic negative to the daytime vista. They became quite well thought, sought after subject matter. In fact, there's a famous picture called American Radiator, made by Georgia O'Keeffe, which I'm going to try and show you. And I'm so sorry for all this scrabbling around. But it's worth a look. Look, I'll show you later. This is crazy. But anyway, basically, the Georgia O'Keeffe, the idea of the kind of like the city skyline with illuminated lights as a kind of big sculpture in its own right sort of started to take hold. Moving on into the 30s, we start to see the use of light take a, as it were, monumental turn with the Albert Speer's work, who surrounded the site of Nuremberg parade grounds notoriously with 150 anti-aircraft searchlights pointing into the air, an effect that remains his best-known work and which was dubbed the Cathedral of Light. Here's a page with a couple of spears on them. I mean, these ideas have sort of gone into the history of art in a way, but, you know, I think people are quite conflicted about them. Were they, you know, obviously they express totalitarianism, but, you know, can we give them some sort of kudos? It's quite interesting because actually that idea of shining the searchlight into the sky, despite its totalitarian usage there, sort of went into the idea of the kind of public art, light in public art, and takes us right through to the current era. Because one of the proposals for Ground Zero was to have been just two sky-pointing light beams. It hasn't been chosen as being a sort of permanent idea, but the three twin pillars of light have been shone from that site on anniversaries of the event. And indeed, it was also announced that the artist Hiro Yamagata hoped to commemorate the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan, destroyed by the Taliban regime, by projecting laser images onto the huge cliff where they once stood. And here, I think, is another and quite interesting aspect of public light, in the way that it expresses the emotional absence, the candle in the window, so to speak. There's also an aspect where of triumph, and there's a picture here of light beams converging above Los Angeles to celebrate the end of the war in 1945 as a tribute to victory. So there we are, with the rays clearly visible. And that's quite interesting as well. So in a sense, we're seeing some strands develop where light can kind of express a memorial, it can express national triumph, it can express mourning, it can express celebration. In other words, it's used widely as to show, as some aspect of national sentiment. New technologies have always offered new forms of light that have been sometimes taken up by artists. The laser, which was first developed in 1960, became an opportunity for a generation of artists, and now sometimes it seems a bit archaic, which is one of the problems with actually engaging with a particular as it were, a fashionable technology. There were some specialists like Rockne Krebs, who contributed to laser light, a new visual art at Cincinnati Art Museum. He was the first to create outdoor laser installations, such as this one, where he projected, called inclined planes, where he projected a whole load of lasers over a town in Pennsylvania. This one is another sort of the greats of 1970s laser artists, if you like, Danny Caravan, who did homage to Galileo, which is obviously in Florence, a sort of laser beam there. And there are several others working in that kind of idiom. The laser, I think, is quite interesting. It had a sort of graphic sensibility that seemed very sort of avant-garde at the time, in that it could describe a precise line in the way that maybe light couldn't earlier. And I think this idea of getting light to sort of, illustrate form or to be form is one of the things that kind of has infused artists over the years. Indeed, laser very much went into the whole world of sort of audiovisual spectacle. And artists like Ioannis Diatope, I hope I pronounced that right, did a lot of work in this sort of area. For instance, outside the Pompidou Centre in 1978, of which there's a picture in there. And then we sort of move on to other things such as holograms, which were always also used in a sense to present a new technology. Harriet Casdin Silver's piece of 1977, which debuted at Castle Documenta, for instance. This piece here was a public light piece that sort of used holograms and light in a way that was kind of very new at the time. And later it became exhibited outside the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. The idea, again, as we saw back in the kind of 20s and even 1880s, of sort of light expressing technology and modernity. As to where we are now, I think some quite interesting things going on, and perhaps something where you know much more about this than I do. This idea of kind of like light as something that has to have a sort of a conceptual sensibility, if you like, rather than merely being the lighting of a building. I was struck by, for instance, this scheme called the Buffalo Bio in Houston, Texas, which is not even yet completed, but will be next year, supposedly. And it's a, as it says here, a larger initiative enhancing public appreciation, access, and use of Buffalo Bio in Houston. Lighting elements located in the bio change from white to blue to reflect changes in the moon's cycle. The 29-day lunar cycle is expressed with white and blue accent lighting throughout the entire downtown area. So, you know, they're trying to do something that works with time as well as with light. It's not episodic even as such. It is basically trying to kind of reintroduce the idea of a natural cycle, if you like, through technological means. In fact, someone from the scheme said, which I thought was quite an interesting quote, "It's incorrect to assume more light means more safety. The important thing is to bring a sense of hierarchy to bear on a particular situation. Light is a matter of putting things in order." There's also the kind of an increasing sophistication in architectural schemes as well, in that the light isn't just going to be an add-on, a bit of slap on the surface of the building, but will be an integral part of the design process. This is Frank Gehry's Walt Disney Concert Hall in LA, of course, and Gehry also designed the lighting, which is very sort of moderate and subtle, but also rather lovely and part of the whole sort of presentation of the space. It's you know, so there's a sort of more integrated, it appears to be this more integrated approach. I was also very interested in this project called Highline, which is an abandoned freight rail line in Manhattan, which again isn't even finished yet, it's going to be finished next year, but it's a sort of soft landscape approach to the freight line, where they're going to create this sort of, as it were, a sort of a leisure walk that's sort of lit in this, in a way that sort of promises to be rather beautiful. I thought that was quite interesting, in that they're not going to sort of highlight it, they're going to turn it into an event, and they hope that it offers an intimate experience at night. I think the word intimate is quite interesting. So basically, what it sort of leads me to think is that lighting is becoming smarter, bringing in sort of conceptual and dynamic ideas and elements that are as much derived from the world of art as from technology, if you like. And this, and obviously the environmental considerations that we all face, should, I think, drive through a more disciplined lighting agenda. As Richard Foley said in 2004, the illumination of architectural and natural heritage sites has become more common without always adding a great deal of value to the image of the town at night. It is time to move on, he says, from lighting development master plans with a monumental approach, including obviously the sort of bombast of excessive floodlighting, to what he terms a proximity approach, the creation of ambiences rather than theme parks that enhance the nocturnal identity of towns. All I would say about that is I think the kind of way to approach that is to bring in as many agencies as possible, artists as well as designers, and indeed technocrats. Because I think that basically we're at a stage where light can't simply be a spectacle. It has to be something more imaginative. And that's really it.
Thank you very much, Oliver. Just before we start the questions, you need a roving mic because, as Maggie said, this is being recorded for podcasting. So please wait until you get the mic if you have a question. And also please say who you are and where you're from. Do you want an immediate question for Oliver from that? I'm going to make an award. For some reason, a dish of chocolate mints was put on the table. So the first person who asks a question gets a chocolate mint. Yep, there you are at the back, yeah? I'll have your chocolate mint for you. Oh, right, OK. It's transferred to the second person.
Nikki Whitlam, Public Arts Officer from the Borough of Poole. Yeah, OK. I mean, it's maybe not that relevant to Oliver, but what strikes me is certainly in my role working with developer contributions and Section 106 is I'm often brought into the process as a Commissioner of Public Art when a building's been built and a developer is wanting to... you know, my remit is to embed the public art as much as I can in the built environment, and it's often quite an afterthought for the planning officer to get me involved. Obviously, I'm working on that sort of wider issue, but light is often seen as being a way by which you know, developers can both embed the art but also fulfil their planning condition or the wording in the 106. And it's really helped some of the words you've said this morning in terms of my writing briefs, you know, the subtlety and, you know, in moderation and, you know, is this just to sort of bedeck sometimes not particularly good architect? Well, but I just want, you know, it's probably something... discussion that might continue, but I just wondered if you sort of had any thoughts at the moment.
Well, it's quite interesting that, isn't it? I mean, I think the days of a developer putting four floodlights at the bottom of their new waterside development are probably over. And I think you're right, it has been seen as a little bit of a sort of slap-on that, you know, hasn't been very intelligently handled, and I think we all sort of know that now. Maybe even 10 years ago we accepted that as it has a certain, you know, it can make any building look grand, can't it? But actually, when you sort of unpack that a little bit, notwithstanding the environmental issue, you know, it actually doesn't eventually create much. And I think certainly from what I've seen, the schemes seem to be heading are towards a more ideas-based work. And I think if anybody works with developers, maybe they can steer them in that sort of way rather than just sort of accepting we have to put a light on it in order to kind of achieve our development objective or, you know.
Obviously, there's the, you know, whole other side that you began your discussion with, which was that, you know, it's light pollution, it's energy sources, you know, it's all those very worrying things, obviously, that the Borough of Poole is really keen on. You know, we want to get sustainability across all our services, really, and obviously this is a very distinct area where we can help. So it is finding that balance, but it does strike me that, you know, the sort of subtlety and the ambience and the moderation in something is much less likely to be a detrimental effect to the environment. So
true, and it seems that there's more event-based light work around at the moment rather than sort of permanent insulation light work. Obviously, the whole light pollution laws last year are kind of... I don't know how far they bit, actually, so far. Maybe someone else knows about that. But, I mean, have there been many prosecutions, I wonder? But anyway, this idea that, you know, you're going to turn your church in your village into a landmark by shining something at it, I think is going to really die a little bit of a death in the next year or so and be replaced by a more kind of intelligent and, as it were, event-based approach, as I say.
Would you be able to, I mean, obviously I'd like to get hold of some information with these light pollution laws. Would you say that the artists are using these as their guidance at the moment?
No, I don't know, to be honest with you. I would guess that some are and some aren't. I think anybody who kind of comes into this sector won't be able to escape the environmental considerations now, even if they wanted to. I think that, you know, it's going to be the sort of... as it were, almost starting point for a lot of people. And obviously, as I was talking about with Justin recently, the technology around at the moment is actually a lot, you know, less... What's the word? Carbonising? What do I say? It's less polluting than the stuff you would have seen 10 years ago. I mean, LEDs and some of these new sort of lighting technologies actually, you know, are in themselves very sort of environmentally, you know, they don't create much carbon, put it like that, you know. So we just have to be careful about the perceptions of these things because it's a little bit like cars where, you know, where 4x4 may have actually produced less pollution than a 15-year-old Volvo, but people give the 15-year-old Volvo a pass, whereas they don't the 4x4. Do you know what I mean? Because it appears to be vulgar or something like that. It affects the world of taste. I think with lighting, people, as we found out, actually, might kind of rather jump upon it as a visible manifestation, something that's a luxury, something that's not useful, something that therefore doesn't need to be there. And we're going to have to argue its case in a way, you know, very carefully from now on. I'm sure some of you have found that already, actually. I'd be interested to know your experiences. And one of those arguments can be how the new technologies are actually a lot cleaner than the old ones.
Has anybody got any examples of the laws, the new laws affecting their work, positively or negatively? No? Okay. Have we got any other questions for Oliver? Can I ask another sustainable question, which is more about sustainability of event initiatives? Because I know when Glasgow did their big light festival, they found that it was a very costly celebration and they probably won't be able to do it again.
Yeah.
Is that likely to be a constraint in the future as well? Is this a high-cost event strategy?
Do you know, I think it probably is, actually. Certainly Glasgow found it to be the case. I'd be interested in any other people who've been involved with any sort of light festivals, whether they broke their budgets or anything.
Just in Gore, we organised the Switched On Festival in London.
Yeah.
Thanks. We organised it within 5 months, so it was a very quick and sharp budget, shall we say. But, I mean, we went over budget on the whole organisation of it. But with a lot of the lamp types we were using with LED technology, the actual cost-wise was very low. Mm. I mean, you can use all sorts of phrases, like you're just boiling a kettle. But that's roughly what sort of the power usage these lamps were using. The cost comes from actually putting all this equipment up and actually manpower, and that's where it gets expensive. We only did, say, 7 projects, and you know, all the probably 90% of the costs came from just the installation. And I think with Glasgow, which is a much bigger project, that's where they would have broken the budget. I think you just need to get some kind of sponsorship.
Mm. I think they were actually part of also lighting all their buildings in the city in Glasgow. I think there was a much bigger project than the festival itself. Yeah.
Yes, it was pretty big, that festival, wasn't it? So I can imagine. I mean, obviously Glasgow seems to have quite a lot of money to put into things like this, doesn't it? Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I guess public agencies have to, you know, weigh up the advantages of having something, particularly if it's temporary, you know, and how indeed then to publicise it, get people to notice it, and actually has it done its job in sort of introducing aspects of the city or the landscape to people that they hadn't seen before, or in other words, in some utilitarian way, in helping the social environment. You know, I think it's a tough one, isn't it? And I think, you know, we have to be on top of the arguments, really. I couldn't prescribe how to do that, particularly. What do you think? I mean, maybe Maggie's got something to say on that.
Hang on, there's one middle there. Yeah. I'll come back to Maggie in a moment. It's the lady there with the hand up.
Hi, my name's Samara Stotton. I work for the Blackpool Illuminations Department. I run a temporary lighting project, the Blackpool Festival of Light. And I'd really just echo the comments that the chap from Switched On in mentioned, in that, you know, that most of our costs are based purely on installation more than anything else, and, you know, marketing the project and that sort of thing. And conversely, with the illuminations, the structures that are created, the new features, are so robust and so, on such a huge scale that they're built to last, you know, a number of years, maybe decades. So it may be that 2 or 3 new features are made each year, but they're on a huge scale. So of course they last, you know. But with the festival projects, the problem really is, because it's a temporary project in itself, every year, everything has to be new. So the question there, I suppose, would be whether you use that money to a better advantage by implementing more permanent schemes.
Interesting point, yeah. I mean, I would say that also with Blackpool, I mean, light is just such a big part of, as it were, the product promise, that it's got to be there, isn't it? So the question, I guess, for you is, you know, how best to spend, to make the light work so it satisfies the sort of tourism potential and gives people what they want and indeed moves the whole sort of idea of the vernacular illuminations forward. Now, I'd be interested to see what you do up there. I mean, I guess, you know, one of the problems with a sort of temporary lighting festival is, you know, there's so much competition, isn't there, between towns and cities and local authorities for publicity, you know, for arts festivals and this festival and that festival. So, you know, what's your lighting festival going to do will be one of the questions that the people who have to sign off the cheque will ask. And it's got to perform some sort of function, I would imagine. And that function might be, as we've talked about, the sort of, you know, greater social functions, maybe even behavioural functions, but also tourism, you know, the appearance of a generation, which is an intangible, things like that.
I think we'll be coming back to some of these points. Sorry, I'll take that one there as well, yeah.
I'm Gabriella Falk, artist. I was really interested in your historical survey, but I wondered if you had anything to say about the aggressive qualities of light and the way people have in the past used that. You did touch on it with Speer, but there's much more to it than that, and the both positive and negative aspects of how that has been used in the past and indeed is used now and could possibly be used in the future. And following on from that, the kind of anti-light festival, if you like. You mentioned dark skies as well. And I was just thinking of a couple of very touristy villages in Somerset that do a kind of Christmas candlelight shopping event, which is very charming. But if you turn off all the lights, as you've also mentioned, you then have the opportunity to use what lights you do choose to have very effectively and very strongly. I just would like to hear your views on that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been, you know, you telling me about those towns in Somerset that have candle-lit winter nights sounds wonderful. I would like to go. It would be my first impression of that. I think the aggressive aspects, I mean, obviously light can be used, you know, I mean, light is used as torture, isn't it? You know, keeping a light on, there are even Geneva Convention guidelines about this. Light the kind of, to use to sort of, as it were, destroy diurnality, if you like, to destroy our sort of circadian rhythms that keep us well, you know, is a sort of well-known kind of manipulator, as with Las Vegas, which, you know, has a sort of don't know whether it's day or night thing going on, and therefore you're in this delirious spending spree, for instance. You know, I'm sure the retail environment uses light in a way that is, in a sense, manipulative. All these things, I think, are very interesting questions, and there is a, you know, a way that light can be used. I mean, obviously, there are negative uses for it. The Albert Speer thing, I think, is quite interesting because, obviously, it is used to, as I say, express this totalitarian sort of image, particularly with the militaristic technology itself being the searchlight. But in a way that Speer has been somebody rather sort of not whitewashed by time, but someone who is still considered to be a great architect, despite who he worked for. You know, the Cathedral of Light, for instance, has kind of, as I say, gone into art history as a great moment. I have to say, you know, without wishing to sound like Dryan Ferry or something, you look at it and it does impress you in a sense. There is something, I guess, very masculine about it as well, if you like. What can I say apart from that? I haven't really found other things akin to that. I mean, I'm sure that sort of North Korea uses light in a way to express sort of, you know, as it were, totalitarian values. But I'm not really sure apart from that. But it's interesting that there are obviously these absolute negativities about light, and that are, I think, increasing with the Dark Skies movement and all the rest of it. Sorry.
We'll just take one more and then we'll move on to the next presentation. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Laura Dennis from Ginkgo Projects. I have more of rather than a question, I just have a short comment, which is perhaps than trying to look at the Dark Skies groups and the such campaigners as enemy, perhaps there's a way to work with them, because as the last question was, perhaps lighting conditions can be even more spectacular if all of the lighting around it isn't unnecessary, can be eliminated, and that will allow further opportunities for more subtle, less spectacular commissions. Perhaps there is a way of finding those, a kind of common ground of those groups, and actually maybe make an ally of them.
This would be a good topic for the plenary session this afternoon.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And in fact, you know, when you talk, I mean, I believe in the Dark Skies movement in many ways. I think what they're doing is really interesting, and they've got a point. And there is something about preserving the night sky from scattered sodium and all the rest of it. I think it's fantastic. In fact, I've spoken to some of them, and you know, they're very anxious to stress that they're not about, you know, being sort of anti-electric light, because clearly that would be ridiculous. You know, what they're about is the smart use of light. So in a way, we're all sort of swimming in the same sort of direction. I thought that sort of what Roger Narboni said about there being sort of, you know, less the sort of bombast and excessive floodlighting, more the kind of proximity lighting, if you like, and the event lighting. You know, this is, I suppose, the smart way to kind of like move this on. I mean, actually, you don't really want this kind of like overly lit environment in the middle of a town. It sort of looks ugly some of the time. I mean, you know, one could also argue that our motorways are overlit. There are all sorts of aspects where probably the lighting is unnecessary in the UK, which I'm sure most of us know is the second most lit country in Europe after the Netherlands. And I'm led to understand that the Netherlands is only the first because of all the market gardening. So yes, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think they're not the enemy at all. I think they are, in a way, about... They could be part of this process. And in a way, they could be consulted as being part of this process.
OK, let's draw that, and we'll come back to some of those issues in the plenary session at the end.